From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, a conversation with Senator John McCain. We'll talk about his primary campaign, his endorsement of George W. Bush, and how his life was shaped by his 5.5 years as a prisoner of war in Vietnam. His memoir, Faith of My Fathers, has just been published in paperback. Also, book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews Margaret Atwood's new novel, The Blind Assassin. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is Senator John McCain. Although he lost the primary campaign for the Republican presidential nomination, he succeeded in calling attention to the issue of campaign finance reform. He has endorsed his former opponent, George W. Bush. McCain left the Republican convention early to get biopsies of two lesions. They were diagnosed as melanoma, skin cancer. The lesions and nearby lymph nodes were removed, and he says the news was good, the cancer hadn't spread. McCain's best-selling family memoir, Faith of My Fathers, has just been published in paperback. McCain's father and grandfather were naval commanders. His father was commander-in-chief of the Pacific Forces during the war in Vietnam. John McCain served as a naval aviator in Vietnam and was a prisoner of war for 5.5 years. I spoke with him yesterday and asked first how his experiences during the primary affected his thoughts on the possibility of political reform.
I believe that the greatest experience of my life was the opportunity to run for President of the United States. It's a rare and wonderful experience and one that I'll always treasure and not look back either with anger or remorse because of the fact that I was a loser. We were able to motivate millions of young Americans to be involved in politics again. And for example, in the Michigan primary, 300,000 voters who voted and never voted in their lives. And so I'm grateful for the experience. I learned that Americans are very patriotic. I learned that Americans want to serve the country. I learned that there is great cynicism out there and even alienation on the part of young people as to whether they are really well represented anymore in Washington, D.C. And they, although they don't know the specifics of campaign finance reform, most of them never heard of McCain-Feingold. There is a cynicism out there that they are no longer represented and the special interests do. And there's a desire for overall reform, reform of the tax code, reform of education, reform of the military, reform of health care. And if properly called, Americans will respond in, I believe, in a most patriotic fashion.
Your biggest issue is campaign finance reform. And correct me if you disagree with this, but I think on that issue you may have more in common with Gore and Lieberman than with George W. Bush. If George W. Bush wins, do you think it would be a setback to your cause?
No, because we will have reform. Of course, I wish Governor Bush would support more vigorously campaign finance reform. In the case of the vice president, he and the president for years said they strongly supported campaign finance reform and yet never set any kind of an example except the worst.
You have your differences with George W. Bush over campaign finance reform and also over taxes. You've opposed George W. Bush's tax plan. You've charged that 60% of the benefits from his tax cuts go to the wealthiest 10% of Americans. Now, took a few weeks before endorsing George W. Bush after you dropped out of the primary campaign. Why did you decide to endorse him?
Well, I always said during the campaign that I would support the nominee of the party. The Republican Party is my home. I never contemplated leaving it. Campaigns and primaries are good. Governor Bush said that I had made him a better candidate. I know it made me a far better senator and representative to have had the opportunity to have run. And of course there were differences, and there will be differences, but he and I share an overwhelming majority of views. Less government, need for reform of education, private retirement accounts for Social Security, a much stronger and revamped military. There's a long list of issues in which we are in agreement, as opposed to just a couple of issues that we're in disagreement.
Do you feel as somebody who's trying to be a reformer, for instance, in the area of campaign finance, that you have to walk a fine line between sticking to your guns and then compromising on certain issues? And how do you figure out when it's counterproductive to not compromise?
Well, Terry, I've been involved in a number of reform issues, reform of lobbying, reform of gift ban, other reform issues, the line item veto. And I think the way you approach this is you stick to your guns and you stick to your principles and never vary from them. But there comes a time when you have the votes. We found this out with the gift ban and lobbying ban and also with line item veto. When you have the votes, then you sit down and negotiate with people and say, okay, as long as you agree in principle, we'll discuss the details. Let me just give you an example in campaign finance reform real quickly. There is an argument that the $1,000 individual contribution limit, which was enacted in 1974, which, by the way, the United States Supreme Court just reaffirmed as constitutional several months ago, should be lifted because $1,000 in 1974 should be raised because $1,000 in 1974 is obviously about $3,000 now. I wouldn't be opposed to that at all, but that would have to be in return for abolishing all soft money. So I'm not willing to say right now I would raise the limit, but when we negotiate, I think those kinds of things are negotiable. But the heart of this thing is elimination of the soft money, which has now proliferated and corrupted American politics.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Senator John McCain, and his best-selling book, Faith of My Fathers, is now out in paperback. Perhaps the most controversial statements you made during the primary had to do with Pat Robertson and Jerry Falwell, when you called them evil and agents of intolerance. You said, "We are the party of Ronald Reagan, not Pat Robertson." Didn't Robertson and Falwell become big political powers because of their affiliation with Ronald Reagan?
I believe what I said, we're the party of Abraham Lincoln, Theodore Roosevelt, and Ronald Reagan. And what I meant by that was that we're a party of inclusion and not exclusion. We're a party of addition and not division. And that I believe that Reverend Robertson was leading our party in a way that made us exclusionary and frankly would doom us to a minority status. And I couldn't articulate my vision for the future of the party without saying I reject that kind of leadership of our party. What I think that Ronald Reagan did was both in demeanor and in action say, come on in, there is room for everybody in our party. That's how they were able to get the so-called blue-collar Democrats, the Reagan Democrats, to come to our side and elect him and re-elect him by overwhelming margins. I don't think that Ronald Reagan ever sent a message of exclusion. Finally, there's room in our party for the religious right, but the religious right, in my view, and the majority of them are good, hard-working families who are wonderful people, but we have to reject people like Reverend Robertson, who say that there's not room in our party for those who disagree on specific issues.
Gary Bauer supported you in the primary race after he dropped out. What's the difference between Pat Robertson and Jerry Falwell and Gary Bauer?
Well, Gary Bauer, who obviously we had some differences, and I had some differences with, that's, again, why I ran in a primary and he did too, I believe has the message of Ronald Reagan. He worked for Ronald Reagan. He recognized that inclusionary message is what wins elections and what is important to the American people. I think that Gary Bauer, with his emphasis on his strongly religious views, which I respect and admire, never, ever, in the many debates and encounters I had with him, didn't articulate a view that we want everybody into the party, even if we disagree on specific issues. That is directly different from Reverend Pat Robertson, who went about attacking people within our own party just because there may be a specific disagreement. And again, I think just as the Democrat Party has labor and people further to the left, there's plenty of room in our party. But no element of our party can be exclusionary and dominate the agenda of the Republican Party.
Well, one of the things that George W. Bush is trying to run on is this sense of inclusion. How seriously you called Governor Bush a Pat Robertson Republican? How seriously do you take his language of inclusion?
I take it very seriously. The majority of his campaign has been one of inclusion and one, as he calls it, compassionate conservative. I don't particularly like the phrase, but the fact is that his message has been and is one of inclusion and one of bringing about a positive change to both the tone and conduct of our government, and I admire him. When I said that he was, quote, a Pat Robertson Republican, was during the South Carolina primary, when thousands and thousands of phone calls were being made by Pat Robertson in support of him, calling my good friend Warren Rudman a religious bigot, a vicious bigot, and there were some things that were said during the South Carolina phase of the primary, which I thought were driven by Pat Robertson. But I believe that what Governor Bush's message has been and is now is exactly what Ronald Reagan and Theodore Roosevelt and Abraham Lincoln had in mind for our party, and I'm very enthusiastic about the way he's delivered that message.
What would you consider like a high point of the campaign and then a point that left you feeling, even if only momentarily, incredibly cynical about politics?
I think that's pretty easy. Two high points, obviously, were winning the New Hampshire primary and then our comeback, winning Michigan, which was a great surprise after we'd lost South Carolina. And the low point probably, obviously, was not just losing South Carolina, because I could feel it. I could see the crowds getting smaller, and I could see the air going out of the balloon in South Carolina. But some of the tactics that were employed against us, I just don't think about anymore. I refuse to allow myself to think about it, because there's no sense in getting angry or show remorse or anger, because there's nothing you can do about it. I mean, it's over. It's done. Politics isn't beanbag, and you look forward and appreciate the great times you had and the wonderful experience rather than look back with any anger or remorse. And I just want to repeat to you, it was the greatest experience of my life. I was just asked by somebody, I think yesterday, do you miss it? And I said, yeah, I regretted not so much losing. I regretted that the campaign ended, because it was so much fun and such an uplifting experience to go to these campaign events and have all these young people there and the excitement and all that went on. That's what I miss more than anything else.
I think one of the campaign tactics used against you that you're talking about was a phone campaign that tried to smear your reputation. Is that?
Oh, yeah, and that of my wife and allusions to one of my children. And you know, I mean, it was very vicious stuff. But again, look, you just can't dwell on that. Those things happen in life. And, you know, Jack Kennedy said, life isn't fair. And what I look back on is that, you know, look, the last day before the California primary, I was at UCLA. It was raining. There were hundreds of young people out there, the face of America, all these different ethnic people whose families had come to this country and done so great American success stories. And when I started talking about the beauty of service to the nation, I could see them respond. I mean, those are the things that I remember the last town hall meeting at Peterborough, New Hampshire. We'd been there the previous July, and 40 people had showed up. That afternoon, 1,200 people showed up. I mean, those are the things you remember rather than any of the bad stuff.
Some journalists have said that something you did was similar to, perhaps comparable to, the phone campaign against you, and I wonder your thoughts about this. And this was the phone campaign in which the message was, "This is a Catholic voter alert. Governor George Bush has campaigned against Senator John McCain by seeking the support of Southern fundamentalists who have expressed anti-Catholic views." Comparable, not comparable?
No. What I said was that he appeared at Bob Jones University. That was a that practice, ban against, quote, interracial dating. That was a factual statement. Where I was wrong was just not having my name on it by calling it a, quote, voter alert. That was the wrong thing to do. The message was factual.
You should have identified it as what? As a John McCain?
This message brought to you by the John McCain campaign.
Mm-hmm. My guest is Senator John McCain. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Senator John McCain. His family memoir, Faith of My Fathers, has just been published in paperback. I know that you feel strongly that a lot of young people are disillusioned by the American political system, and you'd like to excite them and inspire them to participate, to become a part of it. I think one of the things that confuses a lot of young people, perhaps some older people as well, is this, and I'm not trying to imply that there's any choice here, but two people will run against each other in the primary and just really seem to intensely dislike what each other stands for. And then the primary's mm-hmm. over and the loser endorses the winner. You know, mm-hmm. in your case, you know, very heated campaign mm-hmm. with George W. Bush, primary's over, quite a long cooling off period before before you mm-hmm. actually endorsed him, but you did endorse him. So in mm-hmm. in the eyes of some people, probably particularly some young people who are just learning about politics, it could look like, well, they're all phonies. You know, they say one thing and a few weeks later, you know, they're endorsed, you know, he's endorsing him. So mm-hmm. so how do you reconcile that?
Well, I think that first of all, there's some legitimacy to that, particularly people who, you know, pay somewhat surface attention, and I understand that complaint. We received emails and letters and phone calls from many, many people when I endorsed Governor Bush that did not agree with that decision. I guess my point is, one, I said that I would support the nominee of the party. I wouldn't have run if there were no differences between me and Governor Bush. I mean, he had all the money in the organization. Why should I run against him if I didn't have some differences on my vision for the country and the Republican Party? We were and are in agreement on about 95% of the issues. I thought those differences had to be ventilated. Overall, with the exception of South Carolina, that debate and between myself and Governor Bush was conducted in a respectful fashion.
Just a quick question, getting back to something we were talking about earlier when we were talking about your criticisms of Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson. Back when Falwell and Robertson were strong advocates of President Reagan, and this was the period when you're entering politics, did you feel as critical of them then?
No, because I thought they were just a voice in American, in the Republican Party. Pat Robertson has attempted, I believe, to assume a dominating role. By the way, I'd like to make an additional comment. I shouldn't have said they were evil people. That was said on the bus. It's an accurate description. But what I should have said was confine my remarks to what I had said in the speech, and that is that I believe that they were leading the party in the wrong direction and in a exclusionary fashion. I shouldn't have made any personal comment, a comment about their personal character traits or anything else. That was one of several serious mistakes I made during the campaign, because the fact that I said they were evil then dominated the news rather than and crowded out what really was my message, and that was a rejection of their leadership.
When you describe Gary Bauer as being inclusive, and he's with mm-hmm. the group Focus on the Family, does that mm-hmm. include inclusive of homosexuals?
We're in disagreement on that, as we are on several other issues. But that, again, we can have that disagreement, but without parting as friends. Gary and I had a significant difference of opinion and do about normal trade relations with China. I think we should have normal trade relations with China. Gary disagrees with that, but we can have that disagreement. In fact, that debate is being held today and should be held across America.
What would you like to see George W. Bush do about the presidential debates? What do you think he should do?
Well, I think he's doing the right thing now. They're going to negotiate, and they're negotiating, I think, in the next few days. And I think they're going to come up with something that's satisfactory, which will be a number of debates.
You're head of the Commerce Committee in the Senate. Is it true that George Bush tried to get you to convince the networks to carry debates that would be broadcast on their competing networks? For instance, if Larry King moderated a debate on CNN, and to convince CBS, NBC, and ABC to cover that as well?
That didn't come from Governor Bush. You know, staffer, zealous, they're committed to their candidate, but I don't believe that that did not come from Governor Bush, and I don't believe he would ask me to do that.
But staffers did ask you to do that.
Yeah, there was that request sent, yes. But, you know, I think that whoever asked it didn't quite understand that even if I had done that, the likelihood of the heads of the networks to say, oh, Senator McCain wants us to carry this at some huge expense to themselves, I think was a highly unlikely scenario. But it just is not appropriate for me to do that as chairman of the Commerce Committee.
Senator John McCain recorded yesterday. We'll hear more of the interview in the second half of the show. His family memoir, Faith of My Fathers, has just been published in paperback. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. And by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Saab, featuring an all-turbocharged lineup, with safety features like the Saab Active Head Restraint System, SaabUSA.com. And from Random House Incorporated's Bantam Books Division, publisher of the novel The Man Who Ate the 747 by Ben Sherwood. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with Senator John McCain, and Maureen Corrigan reviews Margaret Atwood's new novel. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with more of the interview I recorded yesterday with Senator John McCain. His best-selling family memoir, Faith of My Fathers, has just been published in paperback. It's about growing up in a military family, serving in Vietnam, and being held prisoner of war for 5.5 years. As you mentioned, you said even when you were campaigning that you would support the Republican Party no matter what the outcome of the primary was. Do you think that your sense of party loyalty was affected by what you learned about loyalty as a prisoner of war? You write a lot about having a cause larger than yourself and the importance of that to you. So I'm wondering if there's any connection, or if politics is something really different than the kind of loyalties you were talking about.
Well, I, in prison, I learned that I had to depend on others, not just on myself, and my dearest and best friends, and those that I love, know best and love most, are those I had a privilege of serving with. But in politics, I think it was more of a philosophical position that I held. I believe that Abraham Lincoln changed America in many ways and gave us a blueprint for our party that is held through now for 100 and some years. I believe that Theodore Roosevelt combined both conservative principles and an active role for government, both domestically and foreign policy-wise, is a great role model for me and other Republicans. I believe that Ronald Reagan also articulated an encompassing and frankly, very set of principled positions on issues that they're good for. So the reason why I'm loyal to the Republican Party is because I think I can play a role in making the Republican Party better and returning us to these principles and precepts laid down by these great leaders of our party. So if I had believed that the Republican Party was fatally flawed, then clearly I would have listened to that siren song about being running as an independent and all those things. But the Republican Party is my home. So it had more to do with my philosophical moorings than it had to do with any previous life experiences that I had.
Mm-hmm. In this election, the issue of abortion isn't being discussed nearly as much as it has been in recent previous presidential campaigns. You've described yourself as pro-life. In your political agenda, how would you rate the importance of, say, abortion compared to, say, campaign finance reform? Where do you see abortion fitting in?
Well, I think it's an incredibly important issue because it has to do with one's fundamental beliefs. I mean, there's nothing more important than your fundamental belief, and that obviously has to do with my view that life begins at conception. But I also think that there is some areas that perhaps the Democrats don't want to get into as heavily in the past, such as partial birth abortion. I think partial birth abortion is terrible, and a majority of Americans do. Medical technology is advancing so that earlier and earlier we're proving that there is a life there because children are born earlier and earlier and kept alive. And so I think there's some a lack of leverage on the issue from the Democrat side that perhaps they enjoyed in previous elections. I also think that some of us feel also that when you're getting into basic, fundamental moral beliefs, it gets a little complicated because you have to respect the views of others, even if they are, you know, very strong differences. And what I would have and counseled, and it was rejected, I would have had a preamble to our platform saying, look, we are a pro-life party. That is basic tenet of the Republican Party, but we do not reject the participation of anyone who, just because they disagree on this or any other specific issue, as important as that issue might be. My good and dear friend Tom Ridge, who's the governor of Pennsylvania, he and I are in disagreement on the issue of abortion. But I think he's been one of the great public servants and members of Congress and governors that I have ever known. And so, therefore, I appreciate his contributions to the Republican Party rather than take issue with him because he and I have a disagreement on the issue of abortion. You see my point?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that you're arguing that even people who disagree with that should be upstanding members of the party. But I'm wondering, I'm not sure I've heard you discuss how, in your own mind, you weigh a woman's ability to control her reproductive destiny against your belief that, you know, life begins at conception.
Well, I believe that the process should be that Roe v. Wade be overturned. That would not change very much because it would then return the issue to the states. That's when those like me who believe in the sanctity of the unborn begin then the great debate to convince the hearts and minds of people that abortion is wrong. That is the whole battleground, is to have a debate and discussion, respecting the views of others, but trying to convince people that it is wrong. But just simply overturning Roe v. Wade would just, as I said, return it to the states. Then we need a great national debate, and the woman's right to, quote, choose should be balanced, obviously, against the viability of a human life. And I'd be eager to enter into that debate with the pro-choice people with respect.
My guest is Senator John McCain. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Senator John McCain. His family memoir, Faith of My Fathers, has just been published in paperback. You said that you were the only person in your high school that you knew of who was expected to go into the military. Both of your fathers were naval commanders. Your father was the commander-in-chief in the Pacific during part of the Vietnam War. Do you think you would have gone into the military if you weren't expected to, if it wasn't part of the family tradition?
You know, I don't know, Terry, because one of the aspects of my life, which being a child of the 50s, that I was expected. It was just sort of a natural evolutionary thing that I was going to go to the Naval Academy and be in the Navy. And that was partially what I rebelled against, either consciously or subconsciously, by being such a ne'er-do-well at the Naval Academy. I'm sure there were some regulations that I didn't break while I was at the Naval Academy, but not many. And so one thing I've tried to focus with my own children is obviously encourage them to do well, but not in any way exhibit any pressure towards a military career. And I hope that one of them chooses it, but I hope it would be out of their own desire rather than the pressures that, and look, I love my parents, but it was sort of a thing that was kind of expected in those days. And obviously I'd like to have my children make more of a choice on their own initiative rather than what they might think I would want them to do.
You really disliked how Washington conducted the war in Vietnam. You felt that they didn't fight hard enough, that the war could have been won and could have been won in a timely fashion. And you say that most of the people you knew, well, maybe, am I going too far there?
I think so, Terry. Let me explain.
Thank you.
Very quickly. I think that, look, we had a decision to make early on in 1964, at the latest, that we were either going to do whatever is necessary to win or don't go into the conflict at all. I could argue with you that it would have been probably a smart thing not to go in, given the risk of Chinese and Russian intervention, that we couldn't win without, you know, full-scale operations, which perhaps the American people wouldn't have supported, et cetera, et cetera. But the worst way to approach the conflict is to do it in half measures, which, frankly, people like Colin Powell and Norman Schwarzkopf, who were over there as junior officers and leaders and platoon commanders and air and squadron commanders, understood that we couldn't do that again, and that was reflected in the conduct of Operation Desert Storm. So I am very ambivalent about the Vietnam War. Sure, I wanted us to win. Sure, I'm sorry that millions were sent to re-education camps and thousands executed, and others had to voted by taking boats. But at the same time, you can't go into these conflicts without understanding the nature of the enemy, which we did not, and are devoted to really taking risks in order to ensure victory. And so my complaint about the Vietnam War was the strategy and tactics employed as more than anything else, which were doomed us to failure.
But to sum up, you were very critical about how Washington conducted the war, how the politicians were managing the war.
Yes, and I was critical also of some of the military leaders early on, who knew that the war, that there's no way we could win with that strategy, and should have stood up and said, "I quit, I resign."
Did the war shake your faith in politics? You ended up going into politics, but you must have been pretty cynical about it during the war.
No, I was cynical about employing a strategy which even junior officers such as I recognized was not a viable one. And I grieve and mourn to this day the loss, unnecessary loss of young American lives. That's the real tragedy of the Vietnam War, is those names that are etched in black granite down on the Mall. But my motivation to enter politics, one of them was to make sure that we learned those lessons and embarked on a healing process between the American people and the veterans who served, including our former enemies, the Vietnamese. So my motivation was a positive one rather than one of disillusionment.
Did you, after returning to the United States, ever have any doubts about the war and whether it should have been fought?
My doubts were significant. I read and studied for literally a year everything I could get my hands on about Vietnam. I wanted to know what it was that caused me to spend several years over there, all the way back to the French occupation of then Indochina and all those things. And I learned a lot. And again, I learned that the Vietnamese were, to a large degree, nationalists. That there was a significant disconnect between what was going on the ground and what was believed in Washington. Look, Jack Kennedy at his inauguration said, "America will go anywhere and bear any burden in defense of freedom." And there was the belief in both Kennedy and Johnson and Nixon administration, and if Vietnam fell, the domino theory, all of Asia would fall, et cetera, et cetera. Well, clearly, that was not the case. And in fact, Nixon's trip to China during the Vietnam War was an interesting scenario. But so I believe that the point is that if we ever send our young people into conflict, we have to have clear-cut goals. We have to have a clear strategy for victory, and recognize that if the American people don't support that conflict, then inevitably you are bound to fail. And that's why I admire former President Bush's ability to marshal American public opinion prior to our military engagement in the Persian Gulf War.
If you had done all the reading that you did after you returned home before you went to Vietnam, would you have still wanted to go and fight?
That's a very interesting question. I think I would have. I'm sure I would have gone because I was a career military officer, but I certainly would have had a lot more questions. But very frankly, I don't know who would have answered them. But that question has never been asked to me before. Terry, but I think that I would have had significant questions, but I believe as a career military officer, I still would have gone.
Questions or doubts?
Well, I would have had concerns. We had doubts on board the ship. I'll never forget one time I was assigned a target that came from directly from the basement of the White House that had been bombed 37 times before. 100 yards down the road was a bridge that was not on the target list that clearly the trucks were going over. We all remember watching in the port of Haiphong the Russian ships come in, offload the missiles trucked up, put into place, and then being fired at us. And we couldn't do anything to stop that from happening. It was, some of it was so insane, it was almost ludicrous. And so we could see, those of us who were in combat, how crazy the tactics were and how they really were not hurting the Vietnamese. The only time the North Vietnamese got hurt was the Christmas bombing of 1972, when we virtually paralyzed them with B-52 bombing.
You used to be, I guess, more of what you might describe as like a good time guy. You like to drink. You like to have a good time. Didn't pay that much attention to your studies, as we established. Do you feel like you're still capable of really having a good time? Or has like the whole PW experience, which happened, I know, a long time ago, but has that still at all affected your ability to relax or to enjoy yourself or, you know, experience pleasure? Because I know for some people that really does affect the ability to experience pleasure.
I enjoy every moment of my life. I enjoy every sunrise and every sunset. I enjoy and love the beauty of the state that I represent. My experiences have made me so appreciative of the opportunities that I've been given and the life that I've been able to lead. I enjoy every day, and I look forward to getting up. Do I relax? I have a high energy level, and so I get restless, and I read, and I try to hike and get some exercise in and that kind of stuff. And I, you know, work late and get up early, but that's not because haven't got the ability to enjoy myself. I always have this kind of a feeling deep down that I want to seize the moment and do whatever I can while I have the opportunity to do it.
John McCain, I want to thank you so much for talking with us. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Terry, and thank you for some very tough and interesting questions.
Senator John McCain recorded yesterday. His family memoir, Faith of My Fathers, has just been published in paperback. Coming up, Maureen Corrigan reviews Margaret Atwood's new novel, The Blind Assassin. This is Fresh Air. Margaret Atwood's latest novel, The Blind Assassin, weighs in at over 500 pages. Book critic Maureen Corrigan wishes it were twice as long.
It wasn't a bad summer for books.
I recall reading some terrific essay collections and autobiographies, but when I think back on the new fiction I read, it's all a blur. I have the hazy impression that every other week or so, I read yet another pretty good novel by a first-time novelist. I can't remember any complete titles or names. No doubt it's time for me to start popping the ginseng, but I think I've also found another cure, a literary cure, for early middle-age reading memory loss. That's Margaret Atwood's latest novel, The Blind Assassin. Like the first bracing breeze of autumn, it's blown into and dispersed the muggy literary miasma of summer with a sharp and unforgettable story. Admittedly, for the first 50 pages or so, I feared The Blind Assassin might ultimately turn out to be an unreadable story. Maybe it's another sign of waning youth, but I've grown impatient with self-conscious, tricky narratives, and The Blind Assassin is anything but straightforward. There's the primary story, told to us by a tart old woman named Iris Chase Griffin, that's unevenly split between an account of her present broken-down life in Port Ticonderoga, Canada, and her youth as a society woman in the 1930s and 40s. Iris, who's now in her 80s, doesn't mince words. Here's the arresting way in which she begins her story. 10 days after the war ended, my sister Laura drove a car off a bridge. Yes, we do learn there is a connection between the end of the war and Laura's suicide. Throughout this primary narrative, Atwood also scatters newspaper articles, mostly obituaries, of other people related to Iris who've died before their time. Do we have a murder mystery before us? Maybe. And then there's the interspersed complete text of a sci-fi slash romance novel, also called The Blind Assassin, which was written by Laura and published posthumously by Iris. The novel, which became an instant feminist classic, turned Laura into an Emily Bronte, Doris Lessing, Margaret Atwood kind of icon for young women readers. Sci-fi leaves me cold. So for me, it's a special testament to Atwood's storytelling magic that this weird tale of the planet Zykron, populated by mute virgins and sightless children and lizard men, becomes just as emotionally gripping as Iris's real-life recollections. And as you would expect from a master like Atwood, themes and images intertwine among all these storylines, culminating in a delicious series of shockers. Along with sci-fi, another low-rent genre, the gothic, is mixed into the main narrative. Parts of Iris's personal history read like Daphne du Maurier's Rebecca and Ruth Rendell's masterpiece, A Dark Adapted Eye. Iris tells us about her Victorian grandfather, who founded the town's button factory and moved the family into a creaky pre-Raphaelite mansion filled with stained glass windows and dark wood. There's also her mother, who died young. Iris describes how she and Laura, as children, were playing at their mother's feet under the kitchen table when they witnessed the first drops of blood from their mother's fatal miscarriage spilling on the linoleum floor. Afterwards, Iris and Laura were handed over to a succession of private tutors. Here's how she describes their unsentimental education. Father wanted us taught French, but also mathematics and Latin, brisk mental exercises that would act as a corrective for our excessive dreaminess. He wanted the lacy, frilly, sometimes murky edges trimmed off us, as if we were lettuces. During the Depression, Iris says, she was virtually sold as an 18-year-old virgin to her father's business competitor, Richard Griffin, an autocrat with an affection for Franco and Neville Chamberlain. Richard came as a package deal with his sister, Winifred, a horror tricked out in salmon lipstick and ermine capes. But if the romance slash sci-fi tale has any basis in truth, Iris also had the uncertain consolation of a lover waiting for her in a series of crummy rooms. This demon lover, who's accused of being a Bolshevik and a murderer, makes grocery money by writing sci-fi tales for the pulps. To keep Iris diverted from asking questions about their future, he sequentially spins out a story for her entitled The Blind Assassin.
So what's the ultimate meaning of all of Atwood's tales within tales here, so many of them called the blind assassin? Beats me. Her characters and the period detail in this novel are so lush, like a deep-piled chenille bedspread. I confess, I just sank right in and drifted away.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed The Blind Assassin by Margaret Atwood. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Monique Nazareth, with Anne-Marie Baldonado, Megan Howell, and Patty Leswing. Research assistance from Helen Wong. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. We'll close with a song from Susanna McCorkle's new CD, Hearts and Minds. This is I Can Dream, Can't I?
As we are, the blue horizons bend. Earth and sky appear to meet an end. But it's merely an illusion. Like your heart and mine, there is no sweet conclusion. I can see, no matter how near you'll be, you'll never belong to me. But I can dream, can't I? Can't I pretend that I'm locked in the bend of your embrace? For dreams are just like wine, and I am drunk with mine. I'm aware my heart is a sad affair. There's much disillusion there. But I can dream, can't I? Can't I adore you? Although we are oceans apart, I can't make you open your heart. But I can dream, can't I? Disillusion there, but I can dream.